Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Voices for Justice. I'm your host, Michelle Bart, and tonight we're asking, did the FBI have just cause to criminalize six men in Colorado? You be the judge and jury tonight. Our guests will be taking your calls. The call-in number is 917-932-8962. The chat room is also open. Log on to blogtalkradio.com/NWCAVE and click tonight's show. Scroll down to the page and you'll see the chat room. Were six IRP executives wrongly convicted of crimes? Sam Thurman and Cliff Stewart from a nonprofit, A Just Cause, will take your call shortly. But first, here's a song about the case. Listen to the words closely and listen to these Voices for Justice.
No justice, no peace. Injustice must be fair. Free PM, free Twitch, free TM, and Kendrick. IRB 6 needs justice. IRB 6 needs justice. Department of Justice must answer for this.
Six men locked up, locked out, no doubt. On the bike, scratch, pull hair, scream, shout. I gotta tell it from the mountain. Truth flowing from my mouth, flowing like a fountain. One idea, one man, one plan. Here come the dirty deed, took it from his hands. A liar is a thief is a robber.
Yeah.
You're a devil bastard, not from my father. The time has come, what shall be done? Justice served. One.
No justice, no peace. One injustice must be fair. Free DM, free Twitch, free TM, and Kendrick. IRB 6 needs justice. IRB 6 needs justice. Department of Justice must answer for this.
The lion is a devil. Lion is a demon. Locked up my brothers for no reason. Trumped up charges, stolen code. Now the IRP 6 is on the uphill road. FBI came through to raid his offices. Now all his children getting raised like foster kids. The devil is a beast, so we are the soldiers. Listen up closely, and never say I never told you. Mr. Pastor, Rose M. Banks, on the front line. On the front line.
Wow, what a song. Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Thank you very much, Michelle.
You know, doing the research for tonight's show, two cases come to mind that we've worked on from our organization, the National Women's Coalition Against Violence and Exploitation, and one is the injustice of 14-year-old Yashani Vaughn in Portland, Oregon, who was beaten, shot, and buried. And the individual that did the crime didn't get a sentence that's justified to the family. And another case, which is totally in a different direction, is environmentalist Tim DeChristopher that we've had on this show from Utah, who was prosecuted and convicted by the United States government and a judge, kind of similar to the situation we're dealing with in your case. He went to prison despite all of the backlash for bidding on government property that wasn't even rightfully the government's to throw out into an auction ring. So, you know, I want to begin first so that our listeners and myself included can learn a little bit more about where the six men came from, which is IRP Solutions. It's a software company. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit about the company and what the six gentlemen that we're going to talk extensively about this evening, what their roles were over there and how all of this came to be before the U.S. government decided to, I guess, make an example of the six gentlemen?
So IRP Solutions was a software development. It was a startup software development company. It was headed up by Gary Walker. Gary Walker was the CEO and chief architect of a software that they were developing. The software was called Case Investigative Lifecycle, and it was commonly referred to and still commonly referred to as SILC. C-I-L-C is the acronym for that. And also David Banks was the chief operating officer. Clinton Stewart was vice president of business development. David Zerpolo was vice president of professional services. Kendrick Barnes was the CIO, and then Demetrius Harper was the president of DKH Enterprises. Basically, in developing software, Gary Walker started developing software for law enforcement well before IRP Solutions. Gary was asked to develop a small application that would help investigators through the course of conducting investigations. You know, with automation, everyone wanted to get away from the pencil and paper and so forth, so they wanted some sort of automated method in order to conduct their investigations. IRP was kind of the follow-on to another company that Gary had started because, you know, Gary wanted to have a company name and a foundation as far as the foundation of the company to more readily represent the market that he was in. After 9/11, which was, you know, everyone's familiar with the tragedies of 9/11, you know, one of the problems that was identified by the 9/11 Commission report was that there was a lack of ability to share information and to, as far as interoperability, and among various law enforcement agencies. At the federal level, at the state level, at the local level. The 9/11 Commission report cites that if there had been opportunity in place and methods in place for agencies to share information, 9/11 may have not happened. So Gary had already developed what they called a standalone software solution that was more apt toward small or medium to you know, local agencies, local law enforcement. After 9/11, Gary started doing some more development on his solution that would be more robust to help in that in remedying the situation as far as not being able to share information. IRP Solutions got a call from the Department of Homeland Security. Department of Homeland Security was a new agency that was established as a result of 9/11. And, you know, as you know, it was made up of various agencies like the FBI, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, TSA came out of that. Also, you had the Secret Service was involved, at least in the formation of it. And so IRP got a call from the Department of Homeland Security basically saying that they were working on an initiative. It was called the Consolidated Enforcement Environment Initiative, which would bring all of these agencies together and have a solution available to them whereby they could share information and that they could collaborate. They heard that IRP had developed something and invited IRP to come and show their wares, so to speak, to do a software demo. So IRP went to the Department of Homeland Security, showed a demo. Department of Homeland Security asked if modifications could be made to the software. Gary and David accommodated that, but in order to do it, they needed to solicit the services of additional talent, people who had the skills to do software development, to do software testing, and that type of thing. So in order to accommodate the requests of the federal government in a timely manner, the company used the services of staffing agencies, information technology staffing companies, who had people available that could do these kinds of these types of services. When the government continued to ask for more modifications, so time went by, and you know, IRP felt that and all the signs were there that there were serious buying signals. A contract, you know, would eventually come out of this, not only with the Department of Homeland Security, but the company was always talking to NYPD and then a couple of other agencies as well. Business was not turning as quickly as anticipated. So bills piled up, invoices piled up, debt was incurred, and IRP was accused by one of its debtors as running a scam because of the fact that a bill had not been paid. They, in turn, basically threatened Demetrius Harper and basically said, I'm going to destroy your life. I'm going to destroy people around you. I'm going to take what you have. Oh, and by the way, I know people in the federal government, and that's how I'm going to do it. And on February 9, 2005, IRP Solutions was raided by the FBI. There were 22 armed agents came into the building. And at the time, I think there were probably only about 15 employees in the building. And that's kind of how we got to this point where the ball got rolling, so to speak, as far as the wrongful accusations, first of all, because this really is, in a nutshell, a corporate debt collection case that got criminalized. You had an overzealous FBI agent in by the name of John Smith, and then you had an assistant U.S. attorney in Denver, Matthew Kirsch, who facilitated the case even further. So, you know, as we go on in the call this evening, you'll see that the details around this case, you know, from the inception through to the prosecution, even to the conviction, and even the sentencing, it sheds light on how situations can get over-criminalized and how, you know, it can expose corruption in, you know, what's taunted as the best judicial system in the world. But there are definitely holes in it, and this case shows that.
I would say so. Holes where this all started because a few bills weren't being paid, and people jumped to the conclusion that, or assumptions rather, that there was some kind of fraud going on, when in reality, I believe our own government is in debt, if I'm not mistaken. So I'm sure there's many bills we haven't paid as a government either. So it seems ludicrous to me that they would do that. But then, ironically, you all started. Now, is Cliff, are you any relation to Clinton?
Yes, Clinton is my oldest brother. He's about 12 years older than I am. He is the reason that I ended up coming to Colorado, getting my life straightened out, and actually got into the IT field. He's 12 years older than I am. When I was a teenager, I was in a lot of trouble growing up, born and raised in the streets of L.A., and my mindset wasn't what his was when he was coming up. You know, he always wanted to be, you know, a businessman, somebody who offered more to the community, more to his country. And, you know, I was more of a what you call a knucklehead as a teenager. And at 18, I had gotten in a lot of trouble. My mother sent me to Colorado to stay with him for the summer. And, you know, he really put the big brother coat on and started asking me really, really hard questions. You know, what are you going to do with your life? Where do you see yourself in 5 years? You know, what do you want to be when it comes time for you to stand up as a man and become an example for the next youngster that's coming after you? So, you know, I didn't have many answers for him at that time. And so he began to mentor me in the IT field, tell me, you know, where I could go and what I could do become a viable part of society. And he is at that point I had dropped out of high school for 2 years. He helped to get me back in high school, helped to ensure that I made it through. I got a full ride scholarship to Colorado Technical University, and now I'm a software engineer for about the last 15 years, you know. And he gets a lot of credit for the man I am today, for, you know, standing up as a big brother and taking responsibility. You know, I was his brother, not his son, but he entreated me like a father, like he was my my dad, and really helped me to facilitate, you know, what's going on in my life now. And when I look at it, I mean, he is a veteran. He spent about 10 years in the Air Force. He was in information cryptography, so, you know, he basically is one of the guys that kept the information security intact for the Air Force. And he is an extreme patriot, has always loved his country, has always wanted to do something to help. And now you look at his country is the one that has him locked up for no reason. And, you know, I went and visited him today out at Florence, Colorado. All six of the guys are there. And a large group, you know, we have a very good support system with friends and family and our church family. And we were there visiting them today. And my niece, his daughter, was there. He's a single dad. And so his daughter was there. And her birthday is in a few days. And, you know, she looked at him and she said, "It's going to be another birthday that I'm not going to have my father." And, you know, they both shed some tears over that, and you look at it and you say, why is it that, you know, my family is crying? And you point back to the justice system in this whole situation, and you say, you're destroying families, and it's all because of corporate debt. And to add on to the point that you had made about, you know, our government being in debt, you look at the companies that were basically in competition with IRP. IRP had real software. And you would have the companies, you know, the big IBMs and SAICs of the world, that they would have a PowerPoint spreadsheet and say, this is what we can do if you give us a few $100 million. And SAIC actually did that. They got $425 million of taxpayer money, went out to build what they called the virtual case file, which was software that was pretty much in competition with the Silk software, and they delivered absolutely nothing. And if you remember back in about 2004, 2005, there was a congressional hearing with the director of the FBI, you know, basically trying to hold his feet to the fire, saying, what did you do with $425 million and you have absolutely nothing to show for it? And it was a waste of money. SAIC was never criminalized. No one was indicted. They got a slap on the wrist. And then the FBI got another $350 million that they gave to Lockheed Martin to create this software called Sentinel, which still is not complete. It still does not do what it's supposed to do. And these are the companies that, you know, they're big business that gets the rip off the government, but then you have a small business with a viable product. And as Sam mentioned, you know, Department of Homeland Security reached out to IRP and said, hey, you've got what we need. And you look now and you say the six men that have something that the country could use that could prevent another 9/11, where are they at? Where's this company at? Its executives are locked up in Florence, Colorado federal prison.
Without not much evidence to base that prosecution on, I would gather, because when you're talking about your brother, I mean, he served our country, he put his life on the line, he was willing to die for his country, for all of us to be free, and yet it's his own government that turns around and basically throws him under a bus, along
exactly.
with all the other
and the,
men.
The evidence that they have is overwhelming evidence of their innocence. But when you have the prosecutor, as U.S. Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch, who was the prosecutor on the case, and then you have Judge Christine Arguello, who was the judge over the case, when the judge is working hand in hand with the prosecutor to ensure that there's a conviction. And see, that's what we want your listeners to understand. In the federal system, the judge and the federal prosecutor, they both work for the same boss. So they're partners. So if you don't understand that and you're not extremely careful with how your case is run, you basically have two people on one team and then your defense is another team. So you think the judge is playing referee? It's not how it happened in this case. The judge absolutely ensured that the government got a conviction. And when you look at that and you see a judge that keeps evidence from being presented, that takes expert witness and pulls them off the stand, that violates the Fifth Amendment right of the defendants by forcing them to testify when they have no intention to, by taking the Speedy Trial Act and trampling it in the street. And you look at this judge who does this and you say, why would a judge do anything like this? And as Sam alluded to earlier, you know, as we go further in this, you see how the judge has connections with the prosecutor, with the people who brought this whole case to fruition. The judge and these people are friends. And when you look at it, you say there's no other conclusion to come to except that you all conspired to ensure that these men would be convicted. And it's a tragedy, and there's no other word to describe it except disgusting.
And Michelle, so, if I can add,
yes, go ahead, Sam.
If I can add to that, even when to execute the raid on the business, the way that even went down shows signs of corruption. From the standpoint that when FBI Special Agent John Smith got his warrant signed by a judge, he really got it signed under false pretenses. There's language in the warrant affidavit that says basically that, in so many words, this is a front company. They are not doing what they say they're doing. And then there's language in there that says that they are purportedly developing software. So, you know, he's putting language in there to imply that the company is not developing software and that they are just in place to rip people off. And a judge signed that warrant. Now, here's the catch. There were actually on staff as consultants to IRP retired federal agents. There is a signed affidavit, a sworn affidavit by one of the agents by the name of Gary Hilberry. He was contacted by the FBI and informed that they were investigating IRP Solutions and wanted to get his read on what was going on at IRP. Agent Hilberry replied basically saying that IRP is a legitimate company. They do have viable customers, viable prospects. The software that they're developing is real. We are assisting from a subject matter expertise perspective. And by the way, we know that they're going to sell this thing, and it's something that law enforcement needs, and we want to stick around to help that happen. Also, Agent Smith had contacted the Department of Homeland Security to confirm if there had been meetings that had been conducted and found out that there had been meetings. There's email communication that we have as a matter of record to show that that IRP Solutions did, in fact, go to the Department of Homeland Security on multiple occasions to discuss the development of the software. In those meetings were representatives from the TSA, from the FBI, from the Federal Air Marshals, from the Secret Service, from Immigration and Customs. So here again, Agent Smith knew that IRP was a viable company, a legitimate company, developing real software. Yet he went forward, presented a warrant affidavit to a judge, and got that judge to sign it based on his comments that this company is purportedly developing software. Now, you tell me, who is the criminal here?
Let me ask you this. In regards to this prosecution, did any of the individuals that were being prosecuted against, did they all have the same attorney? Did they all have separate attorneys? Were they, you know, public defenders? You know,
well,
how was their defense?
they had public defenders, and what happened is about right after their indictment, the government, specifically Matthew Kirsch and FBI agent John Smith, went about to basically destroy their credibility and ensure that they could not get viable employment. I mean, these are guys with, 20, 25 years in the IT field that, really know their profession. And what the government was doing was going around to their job. They went to Gary Walker's job and got him fired from his job. He was a director at Kaiser Permanente, director of IT. They went there, sat down, talked with his boss, and laid all of these things out until Kaiser terminated Gary's employment. And they basically did this to all the guys that basically, okay, you can't make money, so you end up getting a public defender. Well, the public defenders, typically, they are after getting you to do a plea bargain. They want you to sign the paper to say, well, maybe I didn't do exactly what the government says, but I did commit a crime. Well, our guys are of the, they are about truth. They're like, we're not saying we committed any crime because we didn't. We're not doing any plea and, copping to anything. And so the court-appointed attorneys, they were basically working hand-in-hand with the prosecutor, Matthew Kirsch, to basically try to get these guys to do a plea, get convicted, so they could, get on with their lives and be off the case. So the IRP6, they basically, rightfully so, went in and fired their appointed attorneys and said, you're not working in our best interest. They found that they hadn't even gone through the discovery information after having it for a year. They had no understanding of the facts of the case. They were doing absolutely nothing, so they represented themselves pro se. And that's when the judge and the prosecutor really came together and ensured that they got a conviction because, you have six guys that they aren't attorneys. They can't afford a high-power attorney because the government has ensured that they're blackballed in the industry and not able to get employment to afford an attorney. And so, and I was there at the trial, and they put on a very good case. But when you have a judge, you put an expert witness on the stand that said, and this expert witness was somebody in the industry that was owned a staffing company, still owns a staffing company. His name is Andrew Albarelli of Remy Corporation. He's been owning a staffing company in Denver for about 15 years, and he had sent a letter to U.S. Attorney John Walsh telling him the way that IRP Solutions did business in this case is the way that the staffing industry works. They did nothing wrong, and if you're going to prosecute them, I can give you 15 other companies that did business the same exact way, and you need to go after them as well. But there is nothing that was wrong. The staffing agencies that were saying, the reason they did business with them or the reason they did business with them was this or that, Mr. Albarelli said that's how the staffing industry works. These guys did nothing wrong. When he got on the stand, the prosecutor objected to him being an expert witness, and the judge went along with him, pulled him off the stand, and ensured his testimony was not allowed, and that was a star witness for the defense. And you look at it and you say, well, why can he not be a witness? And they threw some arbitrary reason that, well, you guys didn't tell the prosecutor that he was going to be an expert witness. He wasn't on the witness list, which were two lies. He was on the witness list from the beginning, and U.S. Attorney John Walsh had a letter from Mr. Albarelli for approximately 3 months before the beginning of the trial. This letter was available to the prosecution. They actually had a copy of it in court that they had brought themselves, so they absolutely knew that he was going to be on the stand. But they had prepared and was going to ensure that the judge disqualified him as an expert witness. And that is just one of the issues that's on the table. And you say, well, how can this be done and how is that legal? And the conclusion from everyone we've talked to and all the research we as a Just Cause has done is that this is absolutely illegal, but the prosecutor and the judge are immune from prosecution. And what we want to get to is, who is it that goes after the judge? Who is it that goes after the prosecutor when they do things like this? They commit these type of transgressions during the case. Who are they accountable to? And who does the public go to cry out and say, we need this judge investigated. We need an inquiry into what's going on. And all these things. And another point that I would like to make is, during the trial, the judge basically forced one of the defendants to take the stand. What had happened is, the prosecutor ended his case a week and a half earlier than he said he would. And so at that point, the defense had to basically, you know, say, we have witnesses, a lot of them are coming from D.C., from the Department of Homeland Security, are coming from New York, from the lived in the New York area, that was with NYPD, that IRP was also doing business with. And so their schedules had to be modified to say, okay, you were scheduled to be here to testify this day or that day. Now we're a week and a half early. When these witnesses weren't able to show up, the judge admonished the defense, and where are your witnesses at? Why are they not here? And the answer is, well, the prosecutor ended his case a week and a half early. We need time to adjust to that. We need you to give us some leeway so that we can get the schedule changed and get our people here. And then the people who were local, most in law enforcement, one of them, Colin Reese, was at Colorado Bureau of Investigation. He was subpoenaed to testify. He just didn't show up. And when the defense told the judge, hey, we have a witness that is supposed to be here, he's not here, can you intervene? And, you know, the law says that the judge has a right to get on the phone, call a witness, and say, you were subpoenaed. If you do not get here, you are in contempt of court. She told the defense, it's your responsibility to get your witness here. Then you have the process server that went to process one of the retired FBI agents that was going to be called as a witness. The process server gets approached by another FBI agent telling him, you are not going to serve this person a subpoena. If you have any questions about that, you go talk to Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch. Why is the prosecutor in touch with the defense's witnesses? And he even stood up in court and, you know, said, well, Your Honor, I talked to this witness. They can't be here for this reason or that reason. Why? That is witness tampering if you are the prosecutor and you're in touch with the defense's witnesses. That's against the law. But when you have the judge working in accordance with the prosecutor, nobody gets admonished for these type of transgressions. But when it came
down, do you feel that the prosecutor and the judge actually were taking their cue from higher authority at the federal government?
Well, I think if nothing else, at the very least, they were working together to ensure that this was a conviction. Because, you know, it's like they resent the fact that you come and fight against them. The conviction rate for federal cases is like 98%, 98 point something percent. And so anybody who fights against the government, it is already put in place that we are going to use every extent of the law, every dollar from the taxpayers, to ensure that you get convicted so that that number doesn't drop. And so you look at U.S. Attorney Walsh, and he was given a proffer from the IRP 6 months in advance of the trial, telling him, you look at this, you look at the evidence, and see and tell us that we did something outside the normal realms of business. And he didn't intervene. And like I said, I mean, there's overwhelming evidence of innocence in this case, and the U.S. attorney didn't intervene. And you know, he's telling his prosecutor, you go in and you get a conviction, because that's what we do. It's not about justice. It's about a conviction at any cost. And then the judge worked hand in hand with him.
And you know,
that
Michelle,
he goes, look into Tim DeChristopher's case as well in the Utah area. He, I believe, served 2 years. Actress Daryl Hannah introduced his case to us, and it was appalling. I mean, he tried to save government land during the Bush administration, and then when Obama came in, he found that that auction was bogus, so he took it off the table. But then the guy still gets prosecuted for bidding on a property that no longer is on the table. So it was really, and he had the same issues you're speaking about your judge. He told us the same stuff about theirs. And the one problem with his trial was that there was so much evidence and so much stuff on his end that the judge would not allow in. Like the fact that the property was, that sale of that property was illegal during the Bush administration. Thus is why the new administration took it off the table. How can you prosecute somebody for buying something that doesn't exist? So there were so many things that the judge would not allow in. And despite his the heavy caliber of Hollywood elite that backed this guy, and the people that made noise, it just seems like when you're going up against the big guys, such as the government, it doesn't really matter who your attorney is, I would surmise, because you're saying 98% conviction rates on federal levels. That's sad, because the majority of those people are probably not really needing to be there on our dime.
Majority of those convictions are based on plea deals as well, because, you know, when you're going up against the federal government, obviously, you know, they're going to put everything on the table to paint the most grim picture that they can paint. And so they basically compel folks to take a plea deal. And, you know, one other thing, too, that I like to point out is the fact that, you know, we say that in a trial, you know, if it's a jury trial, then it's a jury of your peers. But what we found out, and I'm sure other folks have seen this as well, is that juries, if they've sat in any, you know, any in the gallery during any trial, the jury is dismissed and out of the courtroom more than they're in the courtroom. So you have these discussions going on during trial. You have these motions being presented. You have sidebar conversations that are occurring that are pertinent to the case, but the jury never hears them. You can read transcript after transcript, even in the IRP case, where it says there's a sidebar between the judge, IRP 6, and the prosecutor, outside of the hearing of the jury. Well, why can't the jury hear everything that is pertinent to this case or any other case? You know, when people's lives are on the line, the folks who are making a decision on guilt or innocence should have everything available to them. In the IRP case, there was evidence that was not presented that would have clearly exonerated them, like Cliff indicated. Even the expert witness testimony by Andrew Abarelli. There was another expert witness who was not allowed to testify by the name of Kelly Baucom. There was evidence that showed that the software was viable. The prosecution kept painting this picture that IRP was not a legitimate company, that was a scam, and they tried every way possible to prevent the IRP 6 from presenting a case which would have shown that the company was legitimate and that it had a viable product. The federal government and IRP, basically, there was an agreement, or basically in the trial, there was a motion to have the software evaluated. Well, the federal government basically said that, okay, you can have software evaluated, but you're going to have to use someone of our choosing. And, you know, obviously they're thinking that, you know, someone that they pick is going to come back with something that's favorable to the prosecution. Well, they used a company called CaliForensics, which is a software information technology forensics company. The principal in that company is named Don Filfer. Mr. Filfer is a retired FBI forensics analyst. He is also he's a certified fraud examiner, and then he's also an attorney. Well, Mr. Vilfer, he reviewed the Silk software and came back with a report that basically said that IRP Solutions has developed a software, the Silk software, which is viable and could provide value to law enforcement at all levels in the United States, and it is something that is needed. He even had verbiage in there that said something to the effect that there are a lot of companies that proclaim to be able to do everything, and no one can do everything, but what IRP has developed is a very, very good solution, and it is something that would be beneficial to law enforcement. That evidence was not presented in trial. So here's a situation where guys are fighting for their life. A jury is waiting to hear some information that would show that this company is legitimate, that they are producing something that's viable, and they're not able to hear it. So now you have
Did they hear from anybody that was not allowed.
You have something that would verify that they did have legitimate software. While the guys were waiting to go on trial, they were still trying to conduct business so that they could generate revenue so as to pay their debt. Everywhere that IRP went to try and conduct business, they were basically confronted with a reply that something to the effect that they were informed by the Denver, by Assistant U.S. Attorney out of Denver, Matthew Kirsch, that their company was under investigation and not to do business with them. There was an opportunity for IRP to land significant business in the city of Philadelphia. That kibosh was put to that by Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch. So here you have a situation where...
Were there any witnesses called to the stand that actually could corroborate the fact that this company or these six men defrauded them personally or their businesses or their business relationships or if they owed them money? I mean, it's all about this so-called fraud, but who was defrauded?
The prosecution called several witnesses for the government who worked in some of the staffing companies, and there is gross inconsistency in their statements. And so the IRP-6 did, as Cliff indicated earlier, they did an excellent job as far as, you know, representing themselves in trial. They did their homework, and they went through the FBI interview documents where the FBI went to some of these folks who worked at the staffing companies, and they said one thing to the FBI in an interview. There's email communication between the company and IRP at any given time, which said something else. And then after they got on the stand, they said something else. So, you know, in legal speak, that's called impeachment. And so the IRP-6 impeached many of the staffing company or the prosecution witnesses. And by the way, A Just Cause has done several press releases to cover different aspects of this case. And there is a press release out there that was put out probably within the last month or so that actually examined the transcripts. We went through the transcripts extensively and found several examples. We didn't even put all of them in the press release, but we found many of them where government witnesses testified in one manner and then their story changed. So if you like, if your listeners would like to even review some of those press releases, you can go out to prweb.com and just put in IRP6, and you'll see a host of press releases that talk about this story.
Let's talk a little bit about A Just Cause, AJC. It's a 501c3. That's an exemption status from the IRS, which obviously we all know is government. You established it in 2005. I find it ironic that the government put these six gentlemen away, and yet an organization is established because of this case and is affiliated with members of family members of those that went away, and the IRS signed off on the exemption. I find it a little ironic that in one hand the government slaps you, and then the next minute they're like, okay, we'll give you the benefit of the doubt. Let's start a nonprofit for you.
Well, you know, A Just Cause was started, ironically, by the guys participated in the startup of A Just Cause, because when all of this, all of these accusations started flying around, and then when you started to see as things transpired and things began to unfold, that we were all enlightened by the situations that can occur in these types of cases. And so, you know, the attitude was more of, you know, if this can happen to six upstanding citizens of the United States, guys who have, you know, half of them were in the military, so they are former military. All of them were professionals in IT. None of them had a federal criminal record. I mean, you know, when you talk about a record, okay, maybe a speeding ticket here or there, or a parking ticket or something like that. But the guys were major parts in facilitating and standing up A Just Cause, because it was one of those things that we have to draw attention to this case, but not only this case, but cases like it. So, you know, the mission of A Just Cause is to fight where there's been overcriminalization, to fight where there's been wrongful convictions, to fight where there's been even wrongful accusations, wrongful sentencing, in situations where, you know, people are going about conducting business what would in any other walk of life would be considered normal business, but for whatever reason, the federal government chooses to criminalize it. The Heritage Foundation has done studies on overcriminalization. Finally, within the last couple of months, Congress has actually established an overcriminalization task force, which is being headed up by Congressman Sensenbrenner out of Wisconsin. And so it's strange, oddly, that the government recognizes that overcriminalization exists. Other nonprofits understand that overcriminalization exists, yet it still persists. That's why we need, you know, organizations like A Just Cause and have people like yourself to speak out against this, you know, even if some of your listeners may have connections. They may know someone out there who can help to facilitate this case as far as getting it resolved and getting it overturned. Or maybe they, you know, at the minimum, we would ask your listeners to continue to push this story out there to anyone that they know. If they have Twitter accounts, if they have blogs or whatever, you know, we would appreciate any extra momentum that we can get from anyone that's out there, especially, you know, some of the items that we're going through as far as regarding the appeal. And one of the things that Cliff touched on earlier is the missing transcript. When Cliff was talking about Judge Arguello compelling them to take the stand because there were no witnesses available, she violated their Fifth Amendment right to not incriminate themselves by getting on the witness stand. Not that they had done anything wrong, but if you don't want to be put in a position of talking about it because, you know, the prosecution can be crafty, and if, you know, if he asks a question and it's interpreted wrong by the jury, then, you know, you can be taken down a path that you don't want to go down. Well, the transcript that pertains to the sidebar where the judge compelled them to take the stand, that transcript is missing. And there have been motions submitted to try and get the transcript. And when I say the transcript, there are different iterations of a transcript. So what was presented and provided is the edited version of the transcript, which that part is edited out. What we're trying to get is the unedited version, the complete written transcripts by the court reporter. The Court Reporters Act mandates that all records, all transcripts from a court proceeding be provided to the court clerk's office and made available for 10 years for anyone to evaluate, not just the defendants. So this isn't just about the defendants. A Just Cause or any other citizen in the United States can go to the clerk's office at the federal court building in Denver and request the court transcripts for this case, and they should be made available to them.
How long were the six guys sentenced for?
they're sentenced from anywhere from 7 to 11 years in federal prison for these arbitrary charges of wire fraud and mail fraud and conspiracy to commit such. And when you look at the sentencing guidelines, you know, you look at, as Sam said, these are six men that have no criminal records whatsoever. And then you have the judge who, like I said, when the judge and the prosecutor are working together, and then it's like she wants to ensure that I'm going to make an example of you and make sure that nobody else comes against the federal government. So she gives these outrageous sentences of 7 to 11 years, and you look at it and you say, okay, you have this small business. This is a debt case. They get 7 to 11 years. There was an article that just came out about
a debt case. You're saying debt case, not a fraud
case.
They didn't fraud anyone.
Business.
They just didn't pay a bill.
Right. They didn't pay a bill. It's a business-to-business transaction. There were contracts signed between IRP Solutions and these staffing companies. The bills didn't get paid. And then the government says, well, you never intended to pay the bills. You defrauded these companies because you didn't pay them. And that is totally ludicrous. Most businesses, especially in a startup state, incur debt that they are not able to pay immediately. That's why they go into business to take their dream, to bring it to fruition. And, yeah, you have to take some chances. You go in the red, but you say, hey, but I have a product. It's viable. And when you have companies like Department of Homeland Security that request a quote for you from you for a part of your software, and the part that they want is worth $100 million, you're looking at, okay, if our debt is $3 million, if we just land this one portion of this contract, we will then be able to pay off our debtors, continue to do business, and all live a good life and still be able to help the country. And
I don't see them going after corporations.
Exactly,
that
that's the point I was going to make. If you look at the oil
that
spill
that happened, bankruptcy, and then bounce back. I mean, you know, you see it from media to big business to even Donald Trump. You know, no one goes
exactly
after them for not paying.
They don't criminalize any of these companies, but you look at this situation where the oil spill happened in the Gulf, where,
oh, yeah,
you know, I forget the name of the oil company, but,
BP,
you know, everybody's familiar with this case. But they found out recently that Halliburton had a hand in that and that they had hidden evidence about this whole situation. And you're talking about 11 people died, 11 lives were lost.
Mm-hmm.
They were found to be, you know, hiding evidence about it. Well, what happened? Oh, they gave the Department of Fish and Wildlife $55 million. And then when the government finally came to them, they gave them a deal. Well, we'll fine you $250,000. We'll put you on probation. And the Department of Justice agrees to seek no criminal charges against you. 11 humans died in that situation. But then you have the IRP 6 who – they're put in prison for 7 to 11 years. And when you look at where they're saying the fraud, what happened with the fraud, when you have fraud, you always look at, okay, where did the money go? These staffing companies, none of the money was filtered through the IRP 6. The staffing companies had their employees. They paid them they paid them their check. They did what they wanted with their money. The government actually had a financial analyst go through every penny of what came from the staff and agency, and they were able to track it all back. That it went to the employees of the said staffing company. So it's, where is, just like you say, where is the fraud? There is none. The money did not go to the IRP 6. It was paid to the employees that were working for the staffing company. But they criminalize small businesses that, you know, that is coming after the competition because it's all about how much money you can put into the hands of the people that have a interest in the situation.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind
you have these lobbyists who spend millions and hundreds of millions of dollars dealing with the federal government. That's That's why it's not about justice. There's no justice unless you pay for it. And that's what we found out about the justice system, is that America says we have the best justice system there is, but we're finding out that is not the case. You have these tyrannical...
I would
tyrannical,
say Sweden probably does.
Yeah, but I mean, even you have a dictator, but at least he is a dictator in action. He will tell you, I'm a dictator. If you come against me, I will cut your head off. I will behead you. I'll hang you. In America, they go behind your back and use their cronies and use the system against you, and they do
injustice. Because when you look at the situation, like you were saying, if the jury is not handed everything on the case, then there is an injustice. And like Dr. King said, an injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And when you look at places like Arizona, where the jury has the right to ask questions of those being prosecuted, that brings out all the questions that aren't being asked. And I think that's a very good judicial system that they have in Arizona. But when you look at things like Trayvon Martin's case and how a lot of the jurors did not hear some of the stuff that in regards to Zimmerman and his lies, or Casey Anthony, and, you know, how are they supposed to be able to seal the deal? Well, people are walking that should be in jail, and people that are in jail should be getting out of jail, because the system is broken, and this is a prime example. I want to remind our callers, the call-in number is 917-932-8962. I see that we've had someone on hold for about 50 minutes from an unidentified number. If any of you are in online and wanting to ask a question, please call back and prompt, I think it's number one, where you ask to speak to the host. Then I'll know to cue you in to ask you a question or take your questions. We have about six or seven people online, and I'm hoping that they're listening to the show, and if you have questions, please call back and ask to speak to the host. You know, have you all partnered at all? Before I go to that, let me ask you a question from someone in the chat room. What would people be responsible for wrongful convictions of IRP6, prosecutor and the judge, have to gain, and what their competitors have to gain with the six being in prison?
Well, obviously with the prosecutor and the judge, they have what they have to gain. The prosecutor has another notch in his belt, and it sounds, you know, kind of harsh, and, you know, it's like, well, can it be that cut and dry for somebody on the federal level? That is what they're about. When I mentioned about, you know, the 98% conviction rate, that we're finding that is what the justice system is about. Department of Justice is about everybody that they bring to trial. They want to convict them because they have this twisted view of, if we show the public that everybody that we indict, we convict, that shows them we're spending their money well. That is totally, totally, in my opinion, insane. The justice system should be about justice. If you're the Department of Justice, you shouldn't be about convicting everyone that you indict. You should be about ensuring that there's justice to everyone who is accused. And the mantra of innocent until proven guilty, that needs to be flushed. It is so far from the truth. By the time that they indict you, you are, in their mind, you are convicted. You are beyond guilty. They will go after you with every resource possible, which is every dollar that the taxpayer has in their hand, to basically convict you. And that's what it's about. That is what the Justice Department is about. So the prosecutor has to gain another notch in his belt. The judge wants to be able to say that, you know, when I tried a case and it comes down to me going to the next level, or having friendships and partnerships with the prosecutors, that, you know, basically, like I stated before, they all work for the same boss, and so they definitely have a dog in the fight, and a judge should not, but in this case, Judge Arguel definitely did.
They're
and
all elected, right?
They're so all elected. And
they're all elected, so it's all a political, not that all
right,
of them are, but, you know, like you're saying, they all have something to gain. Otherwise, they would be fair, and every case would be fair. And you're right. You know, you're proven guilty before you even walk in the courtroom. So
absolutely. And let me ask you this:
Have you partnered with any civil rights or human rights organizations at all through all of this?
Well, there are several organizations that have reached out to us, and we have we've reached back out to them as well. There's one organization, the Sentencing Project, that we have got information from. The Innocence Project, we have attended one of their conferences and reached out to them as well. We had Friends of Justice has reached out to us. As a matter of fact, Dr. Alan Bean, he wrote a couple of blogs. One was a short narrative regarding the story, and then one was a much longer narrative regarding the story, and we posted those on our websites. He has posted it on his website. Our website, by the way, is www.a-justcause.com, and then there's also a site that was set up specifically for the IRP6, and it's called freetheirp6.org. And then also we're just going to state that when it comes to federal prosecutors and judges, those are actually appointed positions. And so a federal judge is appointed for life, which is even creates more of a tragic situation, because they sit on the bench and it takes an act of Congress, basically, literally, to impeach a judge. And their acts have to be really over the top in order for anyone to even listen. And so, you know, you can identify that there has been some wrongdoing on the part of officers of the court, but it is like pulling teeth to try and get someone to take action. Even in this case, we have sent letters upon letters to several agencies or offices within the Department of Justice, the Office of Professional Responsibility, the Office of the Inspector General, to Attorney General Eric Holder himself, and we will get a form letter back basically saying that that is outside of the purview of this office. You know, how can it be outside of the purview of that office when you are the oversight body or the ongoings within the federal court system? We've also reached out to our congressmen as well as other congressmen. We've reached out to the Congressional Black Caucus. We're seeking a congressional inquiry into this. And we have made some inroads to a certain extent, but not enough. People always shy away from what they call an ongoing criminal case or an ongoing litigation. Well, this case has been litigated. Guys have been convicted. They've been sentenced. And the thing is, they were sentenced, what we believe, based on trumped-up charges. And so they were wrongly convicted. They are sitting in prison and have been there for over a year now based on charges that were trumped up. And then now you have, you know, situations that point to a solid appeal, but the state of Colorado and the District of Colorado, from a federal perspective, has no limit on or no guideline as to how quick the judges have to rule on that. So, you know, that's why we're pushing for anyone out there who can assist as far as helping us to facilitate that. That's why we're doing that.
Well, let me explain to our listeners who may be asking, you know, what does the National Women's Coalition Against Violence and Exploitation have to do with a case of this nature? You know, we're a national, volunteer-operated, nonprofit organization similar to a Just Cause, but we work to inform and educate and prevent violence and exploitation against women and children nationally and internationally. Now, our motto is, NW Cave has a dream. A World Without Violence and Exploitation. And let me tell you, if there are 6 cells not being utilized by a rapist or a kidnapper or someone like we've seen in Cleveland, Ohio, or, you know, or Yashani Vaughn's killer who only got 18 years with time served for murdering and burying that 14-year-old poor girl. I mean, if there's not 6 cells being used for those kind of criminals and being used for your 6 guys, I can tell you that is what's going to light a fire under the public's butts, because everyone thinks that the judicial system, oh, we don't have a loved one locked up, we don't have this. What I've learned from a guest that's coming on the show in a couple weeks, Buzzy Martin, his book, Don't Shoot, I'm the Guitar Man, he used to play in prisons. He'd bring his music to the prisons and all of that. And ultimately, now it's been picked up and the movie's coming out, and Eric Roberts will be portraying him. And what I've learned is over-criminalization, and there's many other people out there that have discussed this ongoing, Jane Velez Mitchell, Lisa Bloom, Buzzy. It's a big problem, and if you think just because you don't know someone behind the bars or you don't, you know, run around in the same circles as criminals, that it's not your problem, it is your problem. Because when your tax dollars go up or your government tells you, I'm sorry, we can't lock up this human trafficker because we've got somebody that supposedly defrauded somebody, but we don't know who they are, then people will start listening. And it really irks me as a taxpayer to think that there's 6 cells being used in Colorado when in Colorado they have an epidemic of human trafficking, drug trafficking. You've got a pot situation going out there that is turning into crime. You've got people killing and murdering and gang activity in every state across this country, and yet these 6 guys are taking up the space that somebody else could, that needs to be. And so that's why we are doing this show. That is why we're doing this show and why we're bringing it to light and why we have you guys on, why Buzzy's coming on in September. We have an author named Kelly Turner coming on who was arrested and prosecuted because it was her 3rd strike of frauding somebody for a $146 check fraud and had to go and serve time and almost did a life sentence for that purpose. $146,
wow.
Really? The toilet paper cost more than that to give it to her. So, I mean, the system is broken, and we need to have a voice for justice. And so I want to explain to our listeners why NWK would have you all on when it really isn't right up what we're doing as far as violence and exploitation, but theoretically it is. And we must all pull together to talk about it, because this is ludicrous, and I had never heard about this case until Olivia came to us many, many times, and finally I said, okay, we'll get you on, because it seems like our summer shows are all about the judicial system, so I would be happy to have you all on. So I wanted to make that clear, because I know a lot of people might be kind of confused to why we're covering this, but we need to have a voice for justice for these 6 guys, because I don't believe that the judicial system benefited the justice system. So if that makes sense, I don't believe that they were able to be given their time to state their case in a rightful way, that ultimately then the jury could have had everything. If the jury didn't have half of what you're telling us, then it's an injustice, just like Dr. King said.
And, you know, I'd like to address a couple of things that you mentioned, and we really appreciate you allotting time on your show for us this week, because, you know, as you indicated, we do have to help each other, and, you know, we will blog out and tweet and support your organization as well. And you mentioned a couple of things as far as you know, occupancy in beds in prisons and so forth. And, you know, we're starting to hear more and more that the prison business is huge in the United States, and that also drives the conviction rate. The prison mm-hmm. business want convictions. There was an article, and you might want to jot this one down for a future reference, on East Bay Express. It was posted online by David Downs just this past Tuesday on July 23rd that talks about how big the prison business is. And it says that about 10% of the $74 billion U.S. corrections market is privatized, and that's up 7% from 2002. So, you know, when you're talking that kind of money on the table, you know, people are going to push for convictions. As a matter of fact, that same article talks about how the for-profit business companies lobby the U.S. government at all levels for more incarceration. So, you know, they want people to go to prison because that's money in their pocket they're going to make. Now, one other question you asked from one of the out of the chat room as far as who stood to gain by IRP 6 being in prison. Well, here's another situation where Cliff indicated earlier the hundreds of millions of dollars that has been wasted on software solutions for law enforcement and investigations. Well, one quote that IRP provided to the Department of Homeland Security, just one quote for a small component of their software, was about $100 million. Just one part of it. And so the business that IRP was doing with the city of Philadelphia would have been into the millions of dollars. So when you talk about monies that were owed to companies by IRP, they could have easily settled their debt if the federal government had not impeded their ability to do business. So when you ask the question who stood to gain, big business stood to gain by putting IRP away. Here you have a small startup company that's competing against the you know, Fortune 500, Fortune 100, Fortune 50 companies. You're talking the Lockheed Martins of the world, the IBMs of the world, the SAICs of the world. You're talking major federal defense contractors who are not about to stand on the in the wings and watch a small company come in and take hundreds of millions of dollars from them. So, yeah, there were a lot of people that stood to gain by getting these guys out of the way.
I know that we've run over. The podcast is still live, so I want to remind everyone before you leave to make sure you share the podcast because typically Saturdays we may not have a lot of callers, but like last week's podcast has been downloaded almost 1,200 times. So that's important because that's 1,200 people that are listening to that and sharing it. And that's what we want you to do with tonight's show as well. We want you to share it so that more people become familiar with the injustices of the world because you too could find yourself in a predicament if you're a business owner, if you're a teenager, if you're a parent, if you're a single mother. You know, the list goes on. And sadly, when you're going up against City Hall, it sometimes the injustices happen more frequently than justice. So please share the podcast. And I would suggest also to both of you that you start using this podcast and the other one that you did on another show and any kind of media clips you have. And I'd start shooting them out to 2020 Dateline NBC because these are the kind of shows that I watch on Dateline and Nightline and 2020 and such. And it's amazing when you're sitting there watching a show that all of a sudden you're like, oh, my goodness. I remember one of their shows did that recently in the last year on a case where this man served like 20 or 30 years for a crime he didn't commit, and then
right.
they let him out, and then the question on Twitter sphere with Dateline or 2020, I'm not sure of the show, was, do you think that the state should have paid him? Damn straight I do. you know, and yet the state didn't pay him a cent and never offered an apology or anything, but yet it was because of a crooked cop that he was incarcerated. And so it was like these are the kind of stories that come to light. So I suggest that you take whatever kind of media packets and such that you have and you get some heavy hitters behind you that may have some influence as far as name recognition and such, and shoot it to the national media because these are the stories that they air and these are the stories that we need to hear about because you need those people coming up behind you as well to have a voice for justice for all six of these guys. Before we end, Cliff and Sam, can you tell us briefly, we've heard about Clinton. Can you tell us about Gary, David, Kendrick, Demetrius, and David? Tell us a little bit about them, their family, you know, and so that they have a voice tonight as well.
Absolutely. Gary Walker is, like Sam says, CEO of IRP Solutions. He is married, has a son that's will be 21 in August. And his son, Kyle, is also epileptic. And this situation has really taken its toll on the amount of seizures that Kyle has. You know, it's seemingly now... you know, when he goes down to visit his dad, you know, they go visit every Saturday. When he goes to visit, it really is very stressful for him, obviously. And, you know, his seizures have really, really increased since this whole situation, since his dad has been incarcerated. But, you know, when we look at it, we say, okay, it's not only the six guys that are being affected, but it's their families, their friends, all of their loved ones. David Banks is also married. He has one daughter. His daughter, Kia, was going to her dream was to go to college to become an attorney. When all this happened to her dad, she had basically said, I'm not going to be an attorney because the justice system is broken and I refuse to be a part of it. David convinced her that don't take this situation and throw your dream away. Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Become someone who advocates for justice as part of the justice system. That, you know, you've now experienced it firsthand. Use that to feed your compassion for the next person mm-hmm. that you see, you know, basically get wrongly convicted. And so he convinced her to, you know, follow her dream and go after, you know, the judicial law and become the attorney that is the one that fights for people and helps out. Kendrick Barnes, we've known Kendrick for about 20 years. He's been, you know, he was actually my college roommate, and he's a real stand-up guy. He's married. He has no kids, but he has a dog named Stevie who, you know, really, really misses him like the rest of us do. And like I said, you know, these guys are not criminals, and they do not belong in prison. Demetrius Harper has two children and is married. His daughter, after this situation came out, was diagnosed with high blood pressure, and she's 13 years old. And you look at it, you say you have a kid who this has stressed her out so much that she has basically now she has hypertension, and so it's destroying her health. Demetrius also has a son who has special needs, and this is really pushing him because, you know, and he's Braylon is, I believe, 7, and when he's at school and children ask him, you know, about his dad, where's your dad at? I haven't seen him come to pick you up. He hasn't been, you know, he runs track. He's a superstar track runner. He always comes in first place. And they're like, where's your dad? He used to always be here. And, you know, what does a 7-year-old say? You know, he can't tell his friends, well, my dad's in prison. So he's telling people, well, my dad's out of town. He goes down there every Saturday to see him. And all he can say is that my dad's out of town. A 7-year-old should not have to be dealing with things like this in his life when, you know, when it happens wrongfully. And Dave Zerpolo, he isn't married, doesn't have any kids, but he is what we consider one of our brothers, and we fight for him just as hard as we fight for the others. And what I'd like to really point out, Michelle, you know, you made the case about, you know, why your show NWK, which is typically a women's advocate group against violence, why you guys would basically be going after this. But what I would like for your listeners to understand is that with this case of the IRP6, now debt can be criminalized by the federal government. It's not just business debt. It is the fact that they can say that you fell into debt, you did not pay your debtors, and your intention was to never pay them. If they called you on the phone and talked to you about it, that's wire fraud. If they sent you a letter in the mail and or you responded to them, that's mail fraud because of all a part of it. And they can say because you lost your job, you knew you were going to lose your job. That's basically what they were saying to IRP. Well, you knew you weren't going to get this business in time to pay your debtors, so you conspired to, you know, against these staffing companies. They can say that about any person in the public. You conspired against the credit card company, against the mortgage company, and when you lost your job, you knew you wouldn't have that job for 30 years, and you wouldn't be able to pay for that house. This case sets precedent that now they can use it against anyone in the public to say, well, case number, whatever, whatever, and, you know, basically we'll call it the IRP6 case. They can use that case against you and say, we've convicted them in that case for having debt and not paying their debtors. We can use that case as case law to convict you as well. So that's what we want everyone to understand is this can happen to you. It's not just that, okay, it happened in a business-to-business transaction. They can use this as a federal case to come after whomever they want to. And that is what is so troubling because it sets precedence to say, we come after you because you didn't pay your bills. All we have to do is have a vendetta towards you.
Well, I want to remind everyone their website is www.a-justcause.com or .org.
.com,
okay. And if you want any information, if you're not in the chat, go to their website. They have links. There's a wonderful documentary film trailer on IRP6 on YouTube. Go to YouTube and put in IRP6. Also, you can look at free IRP6.org as well, and that's a great website for information. And again, I want to give a shout out to the families and the friends and all of the folks at A Just Cause of that's being a voice for Gary Walker, David Banks, Clinton Stewart, Kendrick Barnes, Demetrius Harper, and David Zerpolo.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. All right. And tell them not to give up, to stay strong, be strong, and hopefully with all of you behind them, Sam and Cliff, that they'll continue. They sound like great guys, you know, and they seem like life has thrown a lemon and they're making lemonade. Excuse me,
well,
making lemonade.
Well, you know, Michelle, just to share a little bit more, I know we're just about out of time. Just to show a little bit of the character of these guys, you know, they bring joy and happiness even in the midst of where they are. Demetrius, he reaches out to everyone, and I think he knows most of the guys that are there in that prison with them now. And during visits, he knows their families. He knows their kids' names. And so, you know, these are just the kind of guys that you're talking about. You know, these are family guys, and as we indicated before, you know, they were patriotic. They, you know, they had a dream, and I remember Gary even, I was on a trip with Gary to New York after 9/11, and when there was a meeting set up with NYPD. Stayed in a hotel right across the street from Ground Zero, and Gary looked out the window and looked at the hole in the ground, because the hole was still there before they built the memorial and all this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The hole was there. And Gary basically made a vow that that's why he was doing what he was doing, so as to prevent, you know, another 9/11, to prevent people jumping to their death. I mean, when you're standing on the 60th floor of a hotel and you see how high that is and you look down to the corner of Church and Day Street in Manhattan and you think that someone was in the World Trade Center at 100 floors, You know, they were twice as high as where you are, and they jumped to their death. You know, they were motivated to help the country. And so, like Cliff indicated, you know, the country that they love, the country that they served, the country that they were serving, you know, to be slapped in the face like this is just incredible. You know, and Michelle, I also like to reiterate that the press releases that are out there, we've had some phenomenal reaction to the press releases. Some of them have hit over 100,000 impressions where people have, you know, viewed the pages. Several news agencies, you know, local newspapers around the country have downloaded the stories, and television stations, you know, we've clicked on the links of people who've downloaded it and gone to, you know, where, let's say in Richmond, Virginia, or Baltimore, Maryland, where a television station has pulled some of these stories. So that's why, you know, it's important for us to be on shows like yours. It's important for us to help you to push some of your stories, as you indicated before, to get that grassroots momentum that's needed to bring awareness to these kind of cases. Just like you indicated, you didn't know about this case until Olivia reached out to you and continued to persist. Well, you know, that's one of the things that happens in this country. It seems as though if something is not affecting you personally, then you tend to get desensitized to it, and you don't really pay attention to it. But when it hits home, then it opens your eyes. You no longer become, you're no longer naive to these kind of situations, but you become well-schooled, and you get a little bit of wisdom as to, man, I never would have thought that this kind of thing could happen in this country, but it does. And then once you start digging a little bit, you realize that it happens more than you even think about and more than you care to think about. And it definitely happens more than it should. And so, you know, we applaud you for what you're doing and what your group is doing. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You know, we'd also like to give out our phone number. We have a toll-free number if anyone
Please.
Would like to reach out to us. We also, you know, are trying to assist other folks as well. You know, if they have situations whereby they may need some referrals or in any way that we can help to push information or share information with them, they could reach out to us through our website, and then they could also call us at 877-573-5554. Again, that number is 877-573-5554, and we, you know, we appreciate it, Michelle, and you know, like I said, we're going to help you as well, so, you know, shoot us a Twitter, you know, shoot us a blog, whatever. We'll help to push that out.
Sounds good. Well, I sure do appreciate both Sam and Cliff for joining us tonight. Thank Olivia also for being persistent. And we'll review this again in a few months and see where you all are at. When's the appeal up?
Well, that's one of the things where the appeal was submitted. The appellate document was submitted in January. And that's one of the things that we, as a Just Cause, will be pushing for as well in the District of Colorado as far as federal courts are concerned. There is no time limit on when the appellate panel of judges will review any case. So it's not just about IRP, but it's just any case. There is no guideline. So, you know, that shouldn't be, especially in this case, they have strong basis for appeal. So they shouldn't be sitting in prison when there's, again, evidence on the table to show that either overturn the case or say there has to be a new trial. You know, say something, but don't just sit on the
Give
document.
Them a fair trial. You
exactly.
Know, give them all the information, and if the jurors convict again, then that's a different situation. But give them that opportunity, you know. So thank you both for joining us. I want to remind everybody, again, their website is a-justcause.org. And visit their website. Lots of great information there. And thank you so much, gentlemen. I sure do appreciate it.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you, Michelle.
It was our pleasure.
Thank you both. And I just want to remind everyone, our show is off for a few weeks. Keep checking blogtalkradio.com/NWK for past and future shows. We've gone over 42,000 downloads and listens, and let's double that by the end of the year. Remember to share the podcast. We can't move mountains for justice without many hands and voices. So share the stories. Let's get the conversation started. We're going to end tonight with Martina McBride singing Garth Brooks' The Dance in honor of our good friend Rita Burns, who's on our advisory council as well for NW Cave. So we're going to end with Martina, and hug your kids. Be safe until next time. And again, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. Dr. King said that. So be a voice for justice. Here's Martina McBride.
Oh.